Passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only, exclusions apply. ebaymotors.com.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
What's up, you guys? Sean Ross App, Fightful.com. Here with a name you might know a little bit if you're a wrestling fan, an MMA fan. I mean, he pops up a little bit of everywhere. Brett the Hitman Hart. How you doing?
I'm doing good. Coping well.
You're a part of the Corner Gas animated series on CTV Comedy. I got a chance to check out the episode. I didn't know you were that much of a mechanic. I mean, we know you're a mechanic in the ring, but.
Well, I wouldn't trust me as a mechanic ever. I mean, the last guy you'd want to have looking under the hood of your car.
You were a part of the Corner Gas animated series, as I mentioned. The episode airs first on October 26th. Your get up there, it was a little bit Hillbilly Jim inspired, a little bit Hitman inspired. Talk to me about that.
Well, you know, I didn't have much control over that, but I liked that they gave me brown hair instead of gray hair. So you gotta cut your losses and be happy with what you get sometimes. But the Hillbilly Jim look, I don't know where that came from.
The likeness outside of the gear was pretty spot on. They took you to like you said, the darker hair and all that good stuff. But your return to voice acting, so to speak. What was that like for you, and how were you approached with that?
It's funny because I did it last year. If I remember correctly, I think I really literally just landed from – I came home from Hawaii, and I literally just landed at the airport and pretty much came home and drove straight to the studio and did it from there because I think I forgot that I had it or something along those lines. But it was a very fuzzy memory of after a long flight, sort of just coming in and going straight to the studio. But they were really easy to work with. And, I think when you're a wrestler and you've done as many promos and, speaking on, things like today, even that stuff comes pretty easy to you. I'm sure some of the other cast members like Trish
and Lance.
Lance, it's all sort of old hat to us. So it was pretty easy. I think everyone was pretty happy with how quick and efficient it was. And even though I was just flown in, I was pretty happy with how it went. And they were all great guys and fun to work with. And the script was, you never know how it's going to come out. I don't think I even knew maybe at then, maybe I did. Maybe they just showed me when I got there, my character was going to look like, but I didn't know. I don't think till I got there. Wow. What my character was going to look like.
Lance seemed very honored that even in an animated form, he got to finally face Brett the Hitman Hart. Like, that was a big deal for him.
You got to take it where you get it, right?
I mean, in a world of cinematic matches now, I mean, this is sort of like that. You get an animated cinematic match.
Wow. I'm equally honored to have had a chance to work against him, so to speak. But, like I say, it's always just, it's a bit of a thrill, I think, for anybody the little kid comes out of you all the time when you see yourself animated and actually in a cartoon. And, you know, I've caught some of the commercials leading up to my episode coming up. I think it's next week. It's always kind of exciting. I know, like, my grandkids have brought it up to me a couple of times that they saw me on the commercials, and I think it, you know, there's a sort of a nice little buzz that comes with it. And it's, you know, I was on Simpsons years ago, and you know, that was always a big honor too, just to be, to see yourself sort of walk out in an animated cartoon is you know, it's a nice feeling.
I was going to bring that up. I mean, I remember vividly that Simpsons episode. That was in my youth, and that was my favorite TV show, one of my favorite wrestlers. And today, like, I'll go into toy stores or something like that, and I'll see Bret the Hitman Hart Simpsons figures. So, I mean, you never know, like, how or what will immortalize you, so to speak.
Well, I think the, you know, the funny story about the Simpsons cartoon was you know, that they initially were not going to draw me in as me, but I had just lost the title to Shawn Michaels at the Iron Man match in Anaheim. This is maybe a week or two later, and they flew me in as just I was going to be the Mad Viking or something like that. I was going to be some other wrestling persona that was made up, a fictional one. And I tried really hard to get them to draw me in as myself, and they finally said, it's just the part for Mad Viking, you know, take it or leave it. And I said, okay, well, I'll still take it. You know, it'll be fun to go to LA and do the voice for the Mad Viking. But anyway, so I did the whole thing in about 5 minutes. Like, I drove there in a big limo, and they went into the studio, and I did my lines in about less than 5 minutes. Did it every which way you could think of. More mad, okay, not quite so mad, you know. And then my limo driver had driven off and had gone to get gas, I think. And so I got stuck sitting there for about a half hour because I got done so quick. And all these workers that were working at Fox Studios came out of the woodwork. I mean, like, I'm talking like maybe 100, over 100 people came out, and they had programs and pictures and figures. And so I just signed, I had nowhere to go anyway. So I just signed all their stuff. And I remember when I was sitting there after I'd signed for maybe 30, 40 minutes, I remember, the guy that was the director of my episode came up, and he goes, I had no idea you were this big of a star. He goes, if it's okay with you, we're going to draw you in as yourself now. Cause we had no idea. And so I always thought, you know, just by being a good sport and being nice and taking my time and being friendly with people and signing autographs, you know, they drew me in as myself, which can, you know, never hurts to be a nice guy. So I thought it was always an interesting story that it paid off, because I think it was a bigger, much bigger deal being drawn in as, you know, Bret the Hitman Hart, and having, you know, caused Mr. Burns to go bankrupt and, yes, you know, taking his house and all that. So
no easy task there. And I thought that, I mean, I don't know what the creative, so to speak, was for the Mad Viking, but when I saw Bret the Hitman Hart doing what he did and saying what he did on The Simpsons, I was like, man, how could it have gotten better than that? What could they have had that was better than that?
Well, you know, I did all the lines and everything as the Mad Viking. That's why when people sometimes hear, they go, that's not Bret Hart. You know, it doesn't sound like him. And it's like, yeah, I was supposed to be doing the Mad Viking, so I wasn't supposed to be Bret Hart. So I was trying to have a different voice a little bit, but it's me. And again, it was, they didn't change anything except for the artwork. And you know, I think Hitman was better than the Mad Viking anyway.
So you had voiceover experience with The Simpsons. Did WWE ever have you do any, or WCW, for the video games or anything like that? Because I know that a lot of times that has to be taken care of.
Oh yeah, all the time. You know, you did stuff, so much stuff, like, you do everything under the sun with WWF or WWE. You know, like, you may not have, I may not have had that much experience when I first started there in the mid 80s, but 5-6 years later, you're like, you've got experience. You could do any morning show. You can go on any radio. You can, you know, you're doing live TV. You get so it's the easiest part of your day, you know, and it's, and you just get, you know, I think every, even the wrestlers today, I mean, you learn how to be on TV. You learn how to make your voice work for whatever it is they ask you to do, you know, whether it's a video game or a commercial or a cartoon or whatever. You just, you can do it. It's the, like I say, it's the easiest part of your day. The hardest part is making your planes and getting on the airplane and getting to the town. And when somebody comes up and says, yo, you got 30 interviews. I remember a lot of times in WWE, you know, they would give me a list of radio stations to call in at, like on the East Coast. And when you're on the West Coast, you'd have to call them at 5 a.m. and call one station after another every 15 minutes for 2 hours at 5 a.m.
And make sure they wrap up their interviews in time too.
Yeah. And get on the plane and make like, and it's like, people wonder why sometimes when you wrestle, it's like some days you might look tired, and it's like, you know, there's a lot of stuff that goes on that people don't understand about, you know, the main event wrestlers, how hard they got to work behind the scenes to do radio spots. All that stuff is more important than your match, like to WWE. Whereas me, I was always a guy that most important thing is my match. You know, I don't really care so much about the promos and things like that, but they go hand in hand. You gotta get up in the morning and sort of wake yourself up and slap your face a couple of times and go, okay, I'm calling Atlanta or I'm calling North Carolina. It's, you know, it's 7 a.m. there, and do these phoners.
So the Hitman is romanticized as such a serious character, but we've seen your comedic chops, not just on The Simpsons or Corner Gas. Like, some of my most fond Bret Hart memories are like the El Dandy promo. Like, if that pops up, like, everybody gets a good laugh out of that. Like, you had great comedic timing. And
I did love, I've always loved the El Dandy interview. It was one of my favorites. And, you know, I think because Gene Okerlund was, you know, I don't know that, I can't remember exactly, but I'm not sure there was any rehearsing for that. There was no, like, we didn't even talk about it. It just came off that way. And, Gene was such a good guy to play off of that, you know, it was, I've watched it back many times. Sometimes I'll watch it back with my, my youngest son will put it on and we just start laughing. It's a very, one of my few sort of happy memories of WCW times, you know, where it's like, you know, I remember I did some interview with WCW where, like, then it's like, I said, what am I talking about? What have I got to, like, what do you want me to talk about? And it's like, we don't know. Just go out there, you know, just talk, you know. It was one of the things Eric Bischoff, like, in a lot of ways, I kind of slowly kind of deteriorated my stock in a sense that I had nothing to talk about. It's like, I'm going out and I'm ranting about, you know, WCW fans. I have no respect. And it's like, I'm sitting there going, what else have I got to say? I don't have anything to say. Like, I don't know, you know, who I'm fighting or where I'm going or what I'm doing. And I remember I got really frustrated and I went out and I talked about my cat. I talked about my cat was my only fan, Smokey the cat. And my cat was named Smokey. But I remember it was just the stupidest interview because I had nothing to talk about. It was almost like sarcastic to kind of make it clear to Bischoff in the back that I don't have anything to talk about. The best I can come up with is my cat. And I just remember when I came back to the dressing room, Eric Bischoff goes, I loved the part about the cat. He goes, I loved it. And it was like, I remember kind of scratching my head and thinking, for the money these guys are paying me, they sure got some stupid people here, you know. And I actually remember giving him an idea about the cat, putting the cat in the cat carrier and having the cat in my corner all the time. And he said he loved it. Anyway, never went anywhere, like everything in WCW.
So you pitched bringing a cat to the ring?
Yeah. That's and amazing. Then I actually had an idea where the cat would be with, I would have a real cat all the time in my corner. And then for one of the matches, I would put like a stuffed toy cat in my cat carrier. And I would put like, have a zipper on it. And I would stick the cat in like the insides of the cat with a brick. And then when I was in peril in the match, I would reach like in a, say a Boston Crab or something like that, or some kind of a hold where I was in jeopardy. I would open my cage door and reach it through and grab the cat by the tail and swing it and hit the wrestler over the head with the brick and win the match with the cat, with a stuffed cat with a brick. But I remember I was almost like a rib, like to see if they would just do it. And I remember I was actually, to be honest, it would have been better than anything they did have me do at that time. But anyway, that never came to fruition. But, you know, sometimes you got to just make up stuff on the go all the time.
I think your nephew Teddy stole your gimmick. He carries
everywhere. Better off with Teddy anyway.
Yeah. Oh, man, that's amazing. Did El Dandy ever approach you about that promo?
No, but, you know, I did actually have a lot of respect and high regard for all the Mexican guys. They worked so hard. In those days, they were the backbone of WCW in the sense that they worked all the house shows. They worked on the road. And guys like me and Hogan and the guys that were making the money all the time, we worked – shit, I worked once every – couple weeks sometimes, and or less than that even. And you know, so I always, when I, in those days, like even Benoit and Eddie Guerrero and Rey Mysterio and all those guys worked so hard, and guys like me were just getting paid the big money and working once every couple weeks, and it was never fair. So I had a lot of respect for those guys, and I appreciated how hard they were working. And I think he, I'm guessing, but I'm sure he probably appreciated that that I gave him a
yeah, plug. I would imagine.
And I would have gladly worked with him as opposed to Goldberg.
You've mentioned, I saw actually a recent quote where you said, like, everything he did hurt. Who was the opposite of that? Who was a person that every time you got in there, you're like, I know this is going to be a dream, and I know it's going to look good?
Kurt Hennig was one. Sting was one. Owen, my brother Owen, was one of them. Yeah. You know, we didn't even. And Macho Man was another one. You know, where you didn't need to even talk. Like you could just, if someone said, "Quick, run out there! You gotta go 20 minutes with Macho Man," and we don't know what you're doing. Just figure it out on the fly. And I've done that with Macho Man. You know, some guys you can just work. They're just total pros that way. You know, it's really important for all wrestlers to try to be like that. You know, sometimes I do remember wrestling Macho Man one time where something happened with somebody's flight. I was in Detroit, but they were running another show in South Bend, Indiana. And it was against it might've been Jake Roberts was working against Macho Man, but he got delayed somewhere. Or he couldn't make his plane or something like that. And they told me I was on first match in Detroit. They put me on first and said, you got to get on an airplane, fly all the way to South Bend, Indiana, and wrestle Macho Man. It's a sellout crowd. And, wow. And the main event's not going to be there. And I literally, by the time I wrestled and got on a charter plane to South Bend from Detroit and the time zone change, I landed and had no time. I actually pulled up and Macho Man was in the ring cutting an interview he'd been on the mic cutting an interview for about 30 minutes waiting for me to show up. And they're just about ready to cancel the show or cancel the main event. And I pulled up and they told me, as I was running in, they said, you just go straight to the ring, you know, figure it out in the ring. And I didn't have a finish. I didn't have an ending. I didn't know. Most of all, it was at a time when I wasn't necessarily sure that I could be the main event. You know, it was always questionable whether I had reached that sort of level yet, you know, send Bret Hart out. It's like, is that going to get a reaction? Like, oh, like he's not a big enough star to fill or replace Jake Roberts, say. And, you know, I just remember running out and the place popped and went crazy. And it was like, I guess I'm over enough to replace Jake Roberts and be the main event. And that was kind of the first sort of start of me, I think, becoming a bigger star than just being Bret Hart, the singles wrestler.
And that helped launch and motivate so many people to use the sharpshooter. I remember the story you told about how you were like, I like that move. And I think it was Conan that showed it to you.
Yeah.
who has done the best sharpshooter outside of the Hart family? Because I think that's kind of cheating, because all the Harts, even Natalia uses a great one. Who's got the best sharpshooter you've seen besides you?
Well, I can tell you the ones that have the worst easier.
I'd love that too.
I know Steve Austin had a hard time putting it on. So did Rock. But yes. They would tell you that themselves. And it's, you know, if you don't, you think when you look at it, you go, oh, I can put that on.
Yeah.
But, you know, you got to think about it and actually, you got to kind of know how to put it on to appreciate it. And,
Sean would put it on backwards. I would notice that. He would always have to switch whenever he'd do it.
Yeah. A lot of guys, even when on the screw job, I had to yell up at Sean when he was putting it on. I had to yell up and say, you're putting it on back. Like, and then he switched. If you watch, he switches. And it's like, so I actually helped him put the, you know, the final screw job on right. But I think Sting always put it on, you know.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful, fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99-cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar-S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
The Scorpion Deathlock and the Sharpshooter were basically the same thing. So, yeah. You know, Sting was always he was always a real pro, and he put it on as well as anybody. You know, if anything, he had it first, I think.
So one of my fondest angles was obviously Canada versus USA. I recently interviewed the Patriot of all people, and it seemed like at the same time that angle was so far ahead of its time, but it could it work today with the sensitive political and social nature that exists? How would that work today?
The Canada-US thing?
Yeah, because, I mean, quite frankly, a lot of the stuff you were saying, if you put it down right now, it would be even more appropriate than 1997.
You know, it was the whole thing was initially, I don't know. I remember in the beginning, you know, like they would have me say stuff. And I remember it's like, I'm kind of walking this line between being a babyface and a heel. And I remember a lot of times saying, I got to say something smarter than that. Like, I can't just go out there and say stupid stuff. You know, I'm kind of still a babyface and I have to. It has to be done in a very intelligent way. So I think, you know, there was an effort to keep it pretty smart in the beginning. And that was kind of where it kind of petered out, was when they kind of cut the power on me. I remember it's like Vince mysteriously kind of ran out of ideas about the end of August. And they didn't really push the US-Canada promos for me. I remember Vince was the one that came up with the storyline about sticking the anima, giving Pittsburgh an anima. I remember as that, I was like, geez, that's a bit strong, like, because I always liked Pittsburgh as a city. And it's like, yeah, you got to say that. And it always was one of the things that, you know, I'm not sure I've ever been forgiven in Pittsburgh for saying that. But Vince was hands-on, giving me sort of telling me how to do the whole US-Canada thing. And one of the things that happened after SummerSlam, after I worked with, I think it was the Patriot and Undertaker.
Yeah.
And that time period, they just cut the power. And if you sort of watch my promos for the next 2 months, I'm kind of walking out there and it's the same thing as I had in WCW, where I don't know what I'm talking about. I don't have anything to say other than I'm saying what I said the week before. It's just kind of ranting about Canadians being better than Americans. And, you know, and lost a lot of its power because, you know, ultimately, you know, Vince McMahon, you know, he's the idea guy. And he was a big part of the success of that US-Canada thing working because he was giving me a lot of ideas. And I think it was part of my intentional grounding was okay, now we'll cut the power on him. Like, let him just go out there and he doesn't know what to say. And, you know, it's too bad. I always thought that was one of the smarter storylines. I always loved the line I had about they don't shoot each other and kill each other on every street corner and all that stuff. But, you know, it turned out to be pretty, you know, fitting stuff for the times, and probably would be just as, you know, I don't know, you know, even in those days, you know, I can, when I think of the United States today and how much problems with the, you know, the political tensions that they have there right now. If I go back to remember those days, I can remember, you know, like in some of those places like Montgomery, Alabama, and places like that, getting in my car to drive off after the show. And I would have hillbilly guys in trucks follow me for miles, shaking their fists at me and trying to run me off the road. And, you know, it was dangerous stuff. It was like, these guys are really mad that I'm bashing America. And they were like redneck nut jobs. And, you know, I had a lot of wackos that, you know, as soon as I started putting down America, it was like, you know, serious stuff to them. And, you know, I'm glad that, you know, that nothing bad ever happened from it. I can remember telling Vince that it was becoming a problem for me to leave the buildings at night at the end of the show. Cause I was all by myself at the end of the night, and I got to drive to the next town, and there's fans that would follow me for 50, 60 miles, shaking their fists at me and trying to cut me off. And, you know, it was, again, it was part of a strange job sometimes where it's like, they don't understand the stuff that you got to go through on a 24-hour basis, you know?
Yeah. I watched some of that stuff back and I was like, man, you could have dropped any of these promos in 2020. They would fit right in. Like it would make a lot of sense. My parent company is based out of Canada. I miss Canada a lot. Like, I go there and I'm like, wow, it's so much more peaceful here. And people are nicer to each other on the streets. Like, I thought it was not ever going to Canada. I was like, oh, it's for storyline. No, it's real. A lot of it's rooted in realism.
Well, Canadians have always been sort of the more gentler, laid back version of Americans anyway. Like, we're as much, you know, we're really kind of the bastard child of Britain and the America, because we're kind of like Americans, but we're British Americans. It's kind of, you know, it's very, it's a unique place, and there's a temperament that Canadians always have a good temperament. And, you know, I think we're a better place because, you know, Canada, for the most part, we actually don't mind wearing masks and stuff. Yeah. It's not that big of a deal, you know.
As we wrap up, just a couple more questions. A reminder, check out Corner Gas Animated on CTV Comedy. You had a 20-year contract with WWF at one point, and I believe that the tail end of that was for you to serve as an agent. Is that right?
Maybe. It was all optional. I was going to work in some facet of the office. I was actually under my memory, if my memory serves me right, I think I was going to take Pat Patterson's job. Okay. And work with the matches. And, you know, I don't know that that would have been ideal for me. Just because of the work involved, it was probably something that, you know, at that time, it was like, who knows what I'm going to do, you know, how many years of wrestling. I know that I still believe I had a lot of contributions to be made to the company, and I would have been an asset to them over the years for ideas and just logic and things like that. But, you know, it didn't happen. But I think that was more their loss than mine. You know, I think, you know, once all the bad blood happened there with the screw job and all that kind of stuff, it was, you know, it was what they lost, I think, was immeasurable. Like, you'll never know what I would have brought to the WWE after 1997. But I had so many good years left. You know, I always think, you know, whatever happened with me and Vince and how stupid all that was and how unnecessary all that was, and Sean's behavior and the whole reason all that happened was so stupid, really. You know, that if you look at all the matches that didn't happen, like the the matches that I didn't have with Steve Austin after WrestleMania 13, the matches that I didn't have with Undertaker, the matches that I didn't have with Shawn, and for that matter, Triple H, and all the different storylines that could have played out of our so-called rivalries.
Holy, you know, and like, Angle, and all these people that emerged over the next couple of years.
Yeah, like even Rock. I mean, yeah. It would have been, I mean, there was some great wrestlers that were coming up the, you know, and it's like what they did to me was A, not necessary. It was, you know, I should have stayed there. Vince did what he did out of, petty reasons. And, they screwed me out of, a 20-year contract. You know, they spent more money on Mike Tyson the next year, paying him for 15 minutes of refereeing, as opposed to what they would have paid me for 20 years of work. It's like, I don't know. I'll never understand the reasoning or the logic of what they did or how anyone could justify, and I think the loss of what they would have gained and all the different guys I would have benefited from working with and learning and teaching and passing on what I knew to the next generation, all that was lost. Even I think, for what it's worth, I think my two sons would have probably become wrestlers and probably would have been good wrestlers. I know they both really kind of turned it off after that and never really went in that direction anymore. But, I think if things had been different with my career and with WWE, they would have gladly, end up moving into that, into that end of the business and becoming wrestlers. And, it's just so many things changed on account of, and, I don't want to beat a dead horse, but I've always believed that my brother Owen's accident would never have happened if I'd been there. And so there's a lot of things that,
Hard to believe the Davey downward spiral would have happened too, because that trapdoor incident wouldn't have happened in WCW, and who knows what would have changed then.
Well, yeah, I mean, Davey had his issues and his drug problems, and it's hard to say whether he would have overcome those. I think Davey, if you know anything about that kind of drug addiction, people can't control it. It becomes like, it's like some people have an ability to overcome it. And there's a lot of guys like Test is a good example. And you go to rehab and you got it under control. And a week later you're back on the, it's like you fall, you break with your, you don't have the control to stop yourself from going back on the, getting on that cycle of drugs again. And there's a lot of guys that have the ability to get off, and it's a credit to Shawn Michaels, really, that he survived, that he's alive today. He was one of the guys, and he'd probably be the first one to tell you, and I'm sure he has, that he had a really bad problem. And there's a few wrestlers from those days that had serious drug problems that overcame them and are alive today and living prosperous and happy lives. And it just shows you that with nothing was impossible. And maybe it would be nice to think that Davey could have been like one of them. But, unfortunately, he's not with us. But
last question, we'll let you go. You mentioned Pat Patterson and how instrumental he was in matches. I'm working on a Royal Rumble project, and you had a couple of pretty big moments in Royal Rumbles, from the one that led to Final Four in 97 to the double win in 94. What do you remember about putting those matches together, who helped out, and just the process of a Royal Rumble? Because it has to be a complicated situation for some people, and for some people, maybe not.
Well, it's one of those things that, I think, when they lay out the strategy or the psychology of the match, Pat was always one of the best to lay it out. He always had a great vision. Pat was one of those kind of guys that if you had an idea and you were talking to Pat, if he said to Pat, like, how about this? And then you explain the idea to Pat had an ability to visualize what you're talking about while you're talking. Like, he could visualize it and recognized right away whether or not it would work. And like I can remember when I first started in WWF, it wasn't a Rumble or anything, but I can remember, you know, been there about 2 years. And I can remember Pat coming up to me and going, we were working with the Bulldogs. And he goes, I can't remember what the finish was or anything like that, but I just remember he was kind of out of ideas. And I said, how about this? And I ran a whole finish by him that we had done, used to do in Calgary with the Stampede Wrestling. And I just remember I laid it out to him. Pat looked at me, goes, you can do all that, like just like that. And I said, yeah, we can do all that. We've done it lots of times. And he goes, I want to see it. You do everything you just told me, and I want to watch. I'm going to go out and watch. And we went out and did the whole match like clockwork. And he came back, and he was just blown away. And he was like, I can't believe how good that match was and how – like you had so much in there and so much, you know, it didn't look rehearsed or practiced. It was just, we had done it a million times kind of thing. And I think that was when, in, if I can pat myself on the back, I think that was when they started to realize that I was a good finish guy. Like I was a guy that could come up with my matches and like, you don't need to, I remember with when I fought Davey in Wembley, I remember telling Vince, I went up to him. I said, do you want to know the finish? He goes, no, don't tell me. Oh. He goes, I want to see it for myself. I just want to go out and feel it. Like, I know it's going to be good. I just want to watch it. And, you know, most of the time that I was champion, they would give me a rough idea of what they wanted for a finish, whether it's a DQ or was a count out or whatever, the pinfall or a sharpshooter. And the rest was up to me. Like, you figure it out. You do whatever you want. Because they were satisfied that I would make it the best possible. And I always admire, I always liked that and appreciated that respect that they had for me. And, you know, with the Rumbles, it's kind of, you know, if you're lucky enough to be in the final sort of eight guys in there to kind of be part of the best part of the storytelling of a Rumble. You know, it's, I think if I remember correctly, the Rumble with Steve Austin in Texas and all that, where I got double crossed and I actually won and all that. That was all, I think, Vince. And, you know, and Steve was such a great guy to work with. He was a natural, you know, he had a great kind of chemistry of playing his heel part, especially at that time of being the badass kind of rattlesnake heel that he was trying to be. We always had such great chemistry together, Steve and I. Like we enjoyed the role playing of me being the, you know, I love the look on Steve's face when I walk out and he's like stunned, you know, and he's almost scared that I'm coming out. And,
one of those.
So you know, a lot of that was Steve, a lot of that was me, a lot of that was Vince. It was just everyone gelling together and having good chemistry. And you know, I will say as far as Rumbles go, I think my favorite Rumble was the one with Lex Luger, where we both went out at the same time. And, you know, that was so hard to do. I mean, if you really think about it, like you can both go over the top rope, but you have to land exactly the same time on the ground. It has to be done perfect. And there's no way to guarantee that. There's no way to ensure that. There's this, and in fact, they didn't film it. They filmed it and they didn't show it because they didn't want anyone to go, oh, but Bret Hart hit the ground. Like yeah. He's like way ahead of Lex or vice versa. But I always give Lex credit for that. If you watch Lex, the way I go over the top rope, Lex grabs me and we just flip over the top rope. And, you know, it's great athleticism that both of us landed exactly. I remember they showed it the next day, Vince and Pat, they were so, you know, we didn't want to show anyone the camera angle. But in fact, we can show the camera angle because you know what? You both landed exactly the same time. And that's the beauty of two guys that are good athletes. Lex was always a great athlete and you know, just two consummate professionals in there.
They tried it a few years later with Rock and Big Show and it just didn't work. One of them hit before the other one. It's hard to time. And then they accidentally did it, I think, 11 years later with Cena and Batista, where one of them was supposed to land first. So I think you guys are the only ones that have timed it perfectly thus far in a Royal Rumble. That's quite quite an achievement.
Well, I give all the credit to Lex on that one, because he, if you watch it, I just sort of grab him and he does the flip. And I remember when I was falling over the rope and going to land, I remember trying to pull my feet up. And I'm sure Lex was doing the same thing, because I didn't want my feet to be first. And we both hit the exact same time. It's pretty much a fluke. Impossible to, if we had to do it twice, I don't know if we would have done it twice the same way.
Well, Bret Hart, I want to thank you so much. This has been a career highlight for me, and I want to encourage everybody to check out Corner Gas Animated on CTV Comedy. The first two seasons are also available on IMDb TV in America. Bret, thank you so much for taking the time and being so generous with us.
All right, no problem. It's good chatting with you.
Till next time, guys, we're out.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Without the ones like you who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.